Deadwood Soundwave.
Welcome to Cosmic Void. I'm Biggs.
I'm Xavion.
So today we're covering Rosemary's Baby from 1968. So you'd never seen this movie.
No, I always wanted to, you know. The trailer was just like, okay, we got to see this. We have to watch it.
Yeah, I saw it on AMC late one night. I used to work at a retirement home, which will come into play again when we talk about the blackening next week. But I'm just going to leave that there. I caught, I think, the second half of the movie, and I thought it was really well done. And so I've always spoke highly of it, but I never actually sat down and watched the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Man, there was some nudity in this I did not expect.
You know what? It's weird. My brain works where I'm like, there's going to be some nudity. There's going to be
something. I should have known, man.
There's
going to
be, that was kind of okay for people back then, you know?
We have hit this period where I think we're more closed off to that kind of stuff than we were in the 60s now.
Oh, yeah. I would kill for like a, you know, 60s to like 90s movie, but now, you know what I mean? And let it be really good. I feel like old school movies are always going to be at least good, especially a slasher.
I think it kind of depends, you know, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily call this a slasher per se. Like it's not.
Oh yeah. No, sorry.
Oh no, that's okay.
Yeah. No, not a slasher, but just thinking like I watched it with someone. I'm like, okay, this was the 60s. There was just things that I felt like they just had to happen and they had no way around it. I don't feel like there was like a, we have to refilm this. I think for back then it was just, here's what it is. So let's go
right
on.
Right. Like doing it on film, you don't have super big corporations that are treating it like this total product. Like right. They're still looking at it in the 60s as somewhat of an art thing. And so they just accept that, right? Like they grab Polanski, which let me just say off the top, there will be talk of sexual assault. There will be talk of Polanski's history, which involves that. So we should just get that out of the way. If that's something triggering for you, you might want to turn this off.
Yeah.
We're not going to get super in depth on a lot of this stuff, but like, I think it's important to have that conversation. But Polanski is a guy at the time, he was a European director and they thought that he could actually manage to do this artfully enough. And I think he really pulled it off. And we will have more on Polanski later, like after we talk about the movie.
Yeah,
for sure.
He did good. I didn't think my heart would race. Like I was like, oh yeah, you know, no, my heart was racing almost a lot of scenes. And I'm like, they did really good.
And so much of it is in the mind's eye, right? Like
that's it.
Yeah. It's a lot of stuff where it's suggestive. You're not seeing a thing that's super horrifying, which I feel like they would do today. Like for example, at the end, when you see the baby, you don't actually see the baby in this.
Right.
You see her reaction to seeing the baby, which is probably more horrifying than actually seeing the baby. Well, whatever was going on with the eyes, I think it's way better imagining what's going on with eyes.
Definitely. Like the eyes and like, oh man, when she's like, what did you do? You're just like, what did they do? You know? And then finally you're like, oh, it's alive. But you're like, but what's happening? That part, it gave me chills and the way that the people were talking. And I was just like, wow, this is a 1960s movie. Like, holy crap. They really went in.
The writer is Ira Levin, who I really admire. He also wrote the original Stepford Wives, or he wrote the novel for it, I should say. He wrote the novel for Rosemary's Baby. He wrote The Boys in Brazil, which is about a lot of Nazis escaped to Brazil.
Okay.
And so this story is about cloning Hitler. And it's kind of like a science fiction thing, but it is like three really big things that he wrote. And two of the three things in the Stepford Wives and Rosemary's Baby is talking about women kind of being thrown to the side and how they're kind of put upon by society and expected to be a certain way. And it's kind of fascinating that a guy wrote this story and I think really wrote something that matters, you know?
That's true. Like the person I was hanging out with, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like getting anxiety. And he's like, why? And I'm like, because it's very random, you know? And he goes, I like it. It's just everywhere and all over the place. And I was like, yeah, there's just scenes where you're like, okay, all of a sudden, I'm not trying to ruin anything, but she comes back with like a haircut and you're like, I threw my hands up like, wait, what? what just happened? You know what I mean? There's just a lot to unravel.
I think the haircut thing too is important to note, because at the time that was definitely not a haircut that would have been accepted because it was very, very short. And you think at that time, and housewives are expected to look a certain way and present a certain way. And she's not doing that, which is contrary to what they want. They want her to do everything.
Which made sense, because I literally was like, why are they so mad? But actually you brought that up, and I'm like, oh, that actually makes sense, because that wasn't a haircut you did back then. You know, that was you had to be presentable, and you know, this is what you did, this is how you did it, you know, and the husband went and did whatever. And I think they portrayed that. But then when she cut her hair,
this is a movie that I think mostly plays well today, but there is a little bit of stuff where you have to put yourself into a 1968 space. Like another one is after she had copulated the night before.
Oh.
And Michael Cassavetes' character is just saying, yeah, like you fell asleep and I got anxious and went. And they didn't do anything with that. But at the time, that wasn't even illegal. You know, that's the crazy part of it, is like women's rights are not great today, but they were even worse in 1968. Oh, yeah. And that's just a thing that you would have to swallow and take at the time, which is awful. He's awful in that perfect way. You know, like he's awful in that, like,
you love to hate him.
Yeah. Well, and he's like, he's so representative of that white male, I can do anything I want to do thing. Like I am natural. Like
back then,
I'm doing this for my career. So for my career, this makes sense. And I'm not going to think about how it affects my family.
Yeah.
Or anybody else.
What it's going to do later on in life. Like really, honestly, like when you start to see him, like, he's like, oh, I got this part. And I didn't realize the ailments that people were going through were due. Like, I wasn't putting that to there, because that movie, what was great about it is they have you focused on the baby. Like, what is the baby going to do? And what are they, what's next? But not realizing there's other little side stories at play without you even having to see the side stories.
Yeah. Like everything is tied into the main plot.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily know that when you're first watching
exactly.
it. Having watched that last half, the first time I watched it, I was able to key in on all of that stuff this time, because, you know, I know how it ended. So I'm watching it this time, and every time you see the weird little thing happen, I'm like,
yeah, you're like,
that had to have been them somehow.
Somehow it did. The Tannis route, like, Tannis route. Golly.
That's just like you have some weird hippie neighbor who's a little bit nosy. And I think a lot of people have had that kind of experience, you know?
Minnie was, she's like cutting the cake and then like she's eating really fast. There's also little side stories at play. You want to be listening to what the husband is saying, but you can't help but wonder what's going on with Minnie.
Yeah.
Because she's literally eating that cake and then the husband asks for another one. The same fork she was eating off of, she served him with that and then continues to eat really fast. And I was like, oh, so she's just going to serve him with that cake and the fork. But when I see that in movies, I've noticed when someone's acting that way, but there's like side conversation, side dialogue, you're kind of wondering what that character is like and what she's doing. You know?
And I think Polanski was smart in the way he frames that, because your eyes can't help to pull over to what she's doing, even though you think you're supposed to be paying attention to this other thing. But no, you can see this thing on the side of the frame and you're like, what is going on there? And that's a thing I haven't totally figured out with directors that I've been thinking about a lot lately, is how do they know how to pull your eye to the sides? It's really a talent that I don't fully understand yet, but there's a lot of movies that do it. They just know how to distract you to watch this thing that you're not supposed to watch in the frame, and it unsettles you when you watch it, you know?
It's that, that psychological, that's a good question, because for real, like, I like to focus on a movie, like, especially with these podcasts, like, that movie, that's a focus movie. Like, you should not be doing anything else but watching that movie. I had to rewind it 3 times at certain points, because I'm like, wait, what? There was someone what? And I'm like going back rewinding, and I'm like, oh my goodness, you know? So
this is what I like to refer to as a phone down movie.
Yeah.
I am a psycho in a way. When I watch a movie, my phone is down. But when I watch it with Amanda or my kids, I know that a lot of the time their phones are going to go up watching a movie. And this was one where when I was watching with Amanda, I think she had seen it, but she completely forgot it, because she said she saw it when she was in high school. So I'm not going to say how long ago that was,
because
she
would kill me. Don't do it over the radio.
Right. But she had her phone down the entire time, and we had to take a break in between, because I'm working 2 jobs right now. I was super exhausted. good.
Yeah.
And I just could not stay awake. No fault of the movie. It's just biology, you know? And yeah. So she was like, let's take a break for tonight. She excitedly jumped in on the second night. That's how in she was like, phone was down both times.
Yep.
She was okay with me rewinding 20 minutes because I had started to nod off.
Yeah.
That is not like my wife at all. Like normally when she watches this stuff, she's like, do we really have to watch this again? You know, she'll like go to the bathroom and get annoyed if I pause it or something. She's like, no, just keep it playing. This was one, she was there for the whole thing. Like she was riveted as well. So it was
phones down movie. It does capture you. Like, I mean, just from the beginning, I mean, the song, come on,
haunting.
I was like, oh my gosh, turn it off.
Yeah. Like when you hear that, it's to me, the first thing I drew to it was a movie I watched entirely too young, but loved when I was a kid, which was A Nightmare on Elm Street. And oh, you have that 1-2, Freddy's coming.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think that they were taking inspiration for Rosemary's Baby a little bit by having that soft, almost lullaby thing.
I'm glad I got to watch this because a lot of movies while I was watching this popped in my head. I'm like, so that movie must have came from this. I was actually expecting, because we don't really know what's going on with Rosemary's Baby. She doesn't even know. You know what I mean? To her, yeah,
she definitely does not know.
She doesn't know at all until the end, you know? And so you're just like, oh my gosh. But with the Rosemary's Baby, I saw like Devil's Due.
It's Alive, I think, is one of them.
It's Alive. Yeah, that one. And then there's another one, but it's just, there was a lot of stuff where I'm like, oh, that, okay. And this is 1968. So I'm going to say they took it from that movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I even think there's threads from The Exorcist that run through this as well. Just little tiny things and atmosphere that they grab from. Because that movie comes out like 10 years later. And I'm sure that that was on their mind. And I don't think the devil in the movies were the same before Rosemary's Baby. You know, like once you get Rosemary's Baby, they start to really tap into it. But before, I feel like it's typically some guy at the crossroads who's like offering something for their soul. Like it's kind of the same old trope over and over again.
Yeah.
But after Rosemary's Baby, it becomes a thing where people are working for the devil or the devil is manipulating people directly. It's not just like you make a deal for your soul. Like they're manipulating you straight up.
Oh, yeah.
And you have no choice, right? And that's a big thing in a lot of these demonology movies is like this horrible thing happens and you can't avoid it. It's unavoidable. It is not, I made a terrible decision and now everything's falling down. It is like the decision's already been made and now you have to deal with it.
It was forced upon her. And that was the hard thing about it. The part where she's running, gosh, that movie psychologically could mess me up. Mostly because it was like weird, you know, that grooming. Oh, you know, no, this doctor's great and do all these things and be here. And then there's points where she's like getting there. She's thinking, oh my gosh, this is what it is. Okay, maybe not. Then it was like, oh, she's going through all this pain and she looks like chalk and, you know, stuff like that. And then it goes away. There was a lot of that where it was like, dang, so many close calls with her that I was kind of like on the edge of my seat. And then it's like everybody kind of comes into that factor. Minnie's coming down with her drinks. You got the husband he's the watchful guy. He's
constantly gaslighting her.
100%.
Maybe we should get into the plot synopsis here because I feel like we're pulling at threads here that we could probably be a little more succinct with. So Rosemary and Guy Woodhouse decide to move to an apartment building in New York City after the previous tenant has died at the hospital. Their friend and current landlord, Hutch, warns them that the building that they're moving into has a history. The Trench sisters cooked and ate a couple of children. A Satanist by the name of Adrian Mercado was killed in his loft after claiming he summoned the devil, and a dead infant was found in the basement wrapped in newspaper. The warning is ignored as they finish eating dinner with Hutch. A couple of things shoot out to my mind. If you know you're in a horror movie, there's no way you should move into that apartment, right? Like away, it's just like, no.
I'm sure. I'm totally not going to.
But that's actually what I want to get into is I think realistically, if you're talking about an old building in New York, there's going to be terrible history in every building. This is not an indictment on New York. It's just a lot of people.
Yeah.
any given apartment building is going to have a murder in it of some sort, maybe multiple ones. Like over that many decades, from so many people being in there, moving in and out, I feel like the odds.
Fair enough.
Right. I feel like I would totally move into there and ignore it. Exactly. So I just want to be real about this.
Yeah.
From a movie standpoint, you're like, don't move in there.
Don't do it. But then it's like, but there's history. You're like, oh, like one of the scenes, like as soon as they walk into the house, I'm like, dang, that's really vintage. I like it.
Right.
I couldn't live there, but I like it.
And also, and I don't know what it was like in 68, but from what I know of New York, it's so huge. I'm like, you have to take that place wow, dude.
That's an apartment.
And it's cheap. I think they say like it's totally affordable. So.
I'll be honest. I liked that setting, that vintage. I would never live in a vintage. I already said that, you know, to my other friend. I was like, I would never like live there. But
I'll be honest, man. I lived in a Victorian mansion for a while. I am not rich. Like we could hardly afford it. We were renting it.
Yeah.
But it was the only thing that had enough bedrooms for all our kids. But there was things that were really cool about it and things that were really creepy about it. And one of the creepy things was there was this old picture that was hanging up because they had things that were around, and it was like a very early photograph of a kid. And I know from watching documentaries that when they had a photo of a kid like that, it meant almost always the kid was dead. They used to take portraits of people to remember them and their family, but they tended to do it later in their life. And so when a child died early, they would take the painting of the dead child so that they could remember them. And once photographs came around, they were like, okay, so we're going to do that. Because photographs took about 10 minutes to do.
Yeah.
You had to sit very still, which is why a lot of them are blurry, is because people are moving a little bit. And it wasn't an instantaneous thing.
Yeah.
But like you see those pictures of kids who are the most squirmy things, and it's like crystal clear for the time. And you're like, oh, that was a dead kid. And they would put them on standers and stuff.
Oh.
So my kid's room had a picture of a dead kid. Like I just know this. I'm not sharing that with my kid at all, but I know this is a fact. So right away, that's creepy.
Yeah.
Also, steam pipes. When it heats up, it sounds like somebody's banging on a pipe.
Yeah. So, you're like, hello?
So when you say, I'm not doing vintage, I get it because I did that and it was creepy sometimes.
Heck no, I'm not doing it. Not when you hear, oh, there was three people late inside. No, absolutely not.
There was children that were eight.
Like if someone was like, oh yeah, I died of a heart attack or something. Okay, fine. I'm moving in there. Now I heard somebody was eating people at, no, not my kind of place. Not doing it.
The Woodhouse move into the building. Rosemary meets a recovered drug addict named Terry while doing laundry in the creepy basement. She tells Rosemary that Minnie and Roman Castavet, Rosemary's neighbors, took her to help her get clean. Later, Terry is found dead on the pavement, apparently jumping out of the Castavet's seventh floor apartment. The Castavets look distraught, but then quickly take to Rosemary and Guy. Minnie gives Terry's pendant, which has a bit of an odor, to Rosemary, saying it's a good luck charm that contains tannis root. So, like, these neighbors, I immediately get a bad vibe watching them because they're so distraught and then just like turn on a heel, which tells me they were never distraught.
No, not at all. Like the way they walked up at first, you're like, oh man, they really cared for this woman. And then like, then she starts showing up other places and downstairs. You're like, oh, yeah, I guess you're fine. It's the way she comes in to their lives that it was like, dang, Terry, what was going on upstairs? What was really happening?
All right, so let's speculate a little bit here because we've already given away that this is a Satanist plot, essentially.
Yeah.
And by the way, Satanists are not like this. They tend to be, at least the people I knew were like weird kind of gothy people. It's not a big deal. They just listened to a lot of Typo Negative and stuff. But what do you think happened with Terry? Like, my theory is that she was a sacrifice. But then it's also possible that she was in on it and sacrificed herself. I don't know. But what do you think when you pull back and think about this? Because they don't tell you. They might in the book, but I have no idea.
They don't tell you. First of all, that scene was gruesome. I wasn't ready for that. I mean, not that I haven't seen gruesome, but just like the way.
Because you're watching an older movie and you don't think they're going to go there.
Yeah. And then like, it was crazy. The only thing that would throw me when they're in the laundry room or the laundry basement, whatever, and that thing breaks and they kind of just go, oh, and then go old building and let it go.
Yeah.
I feel like then something was going on. I think so.
You know what I mean?
Like, I think for...
When they even talk about a child was found in the basement,
In the basement, right. So I was like, interesting. I'm like, so are we dealing with a haunting at this point? Did she get pushed? Did they throw her? Or was she sacrificed? But, like, the weird thing is you don't take Terry as a drug addict who was, I think, was she a prostitute too?
I think they allude to it, but don't say it.
Yeah. So, like, she had all these things going on, and then you see her and what they're doing for her and how they're helping her. And then there's, oh, by the way, folks, there's no time frame on this. So there's nothing like saying, oh, New York, 1968, you know, this time. It's literally just kind of scene by scene by scene, and you're kind of to put it together. So I don't know how long her and Terry were friends for that to happen. Because did she die the next day after they talked? Or was it... Because it seemed like the husband knew her.
I don't know. It's kind of undetermined. It's pretty quickly after they move in, for sure, though, right?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they moved... they moved in. She meets Terry in the basement. That whole thing happens. And then the next scene, Terry's dead, you know? And you're just kind of like, well, what happened? But she still has the pendant around her, though.
Yeah.
Because she showed homegirl the pendant. Rosemary's like, oh, that's an awful odor. And then kind of from there, it escalated. So I don't know if Terry really knew exactly what was going on, or if she just kind of was just, maybe she was just a sacrifice. That's why they didn't really care.
After having dinner with the cast of Vets a couple of times, Rosemary finds them annoying. Guy at first doesn't want to meet with them, but takes to them very quickly. He's suddenly cast in a play after the lead actor went blind from out of nowhere. Now that Guy has made it, he wants to conceive a baby. Minnie brings over chocolate mousse for their dessert. Rosemary says it has a chalky undertaste, which I've never heard that term undertaste before.
Yeah.
You understand what she means, but it's like undertaste?
Yeah, like hold on.
But Guy says she's ungrateful. She eats a little and then throws the rest out behind his back. Rosemary gets dizzy and sees herself being assaulted by a demon as her husband and all the tenants watch nude. She wakes up with scratches. Guy tells her he started while she was passed out and hadn't cut his nails. Everything with that is just so gross.
It definitely made my mind go like, dang, we're for real doing this. And then you really find out that the husband was pretty much in on it too, you know?
So Rosemary and the husband have this complete turnaround, right? Because Rosemary is the one who wants to meet with the neighbors and thinks that they're kind of nice, and Guy can't stand them.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand why Rosemary gets turned around, because to me, it's like, I've moved in places, including the place I'm at right now.
Yeah.
Not with the neighbors I have right now, but the neighbors I had when I first moved in, and they were kind of nosy. And you're like getting along at first, and then it just gets so annoying.
Weird.
And every time I would come home, they're just stopping me at the front door and having to try and talk to me for 20, 30 minutes.
To the
minutes,
point where you're like, I have groceries. I just want to go inside.
Yeah, dude, like I'm literally holding milk right now. Come
milk,
on.
Two cases of water. What do you want? You know?
Yeah, I'm holding a shopping bag with a baguette hanging out like a movie.
Just let me get inside. No, the neighbors.
So the fact that he turns around tells you there's something going on right there.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, again, everyone, this movie, the time frame, he didn't want to go, and they were still talking trash when they went downstairs, but then he was really excited to go over the next day.
Yeah.
And you're
it
just
feels
like
tonal whiplash, but when you know what's going on later in the movie, it makes sense when you rewatch it, right?
Exactly. Cause then you're like, I wanted to like the husband at first. Like even the part where he's there, she's like, let's make love. I'm sorry, that scene was kind of funny and like awkward.
Yes. Yes.
So awkward. That was the most it was just weird for a married couple to be acting that way and like everything else. But with him,
because they're like in the dark and it's not super romantic, it feels a little
he's
transactional.
He's like on his back, already like taking his pants off, and she's separate, taking her. And it's like, oh, are you guys
It feels like it's a business ordeal. It's not like a romantic encounter.
Yes,
right?
Thank you. Yeah. I could not figure out. Like, it's like they signed a contract, like, well, we have to make love, you know, once a week. We have to make this baby.
No, I didn't really think about it at the time, but now that you're bringing this up, that has to be intentional, right? Like, this is her duty as far as she's concerned, is she's supposed to do this. So they're just kind of going through the motions. And even he's not swept up in it either. It's just like,
not.
We're in an apartment, so we're in a new home. I guess we better do this. And then she's like, yeah, I guess we better.
Fine. Contract says. No.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the husband, there's a lot that with the husband to the neighbors and everything something else that you really catch on and you're like, okay, he's a piece of crap and we all know it. And let's just see where it goes.
And then you get into that dream, and which is not a dream, you know, as we find out.
Oh my gosh.
It's crazy. And that's where it's just like, oh yeah, 1968. It's around the time of Free Love and stuff. They're going to go there. And they go there in a way that you would not in a movie today. You just not would not.
Not to interrupt you. What did you feel? Oh my gosh. I can't even get this out. But what did you feel when she goes, this is not a dream?
I was like, no, it's not. I've already seen this. It's not. I did not see that part.
Oh my gosh.
And I suspect they edited it quite a bit for AMC when I had originally seen it 20 years ago.
I got chills from that. When she realizes, this is not a dream, I was like, what?
And once again, you know, we talked about it before, but he's saying, like, I got started without you, essentially, which is just, like, all kinds of warning bells. And I do wonder how it played at the time, because I feel like it was supposed to play, like, maybe this is a normal thing, but it shouldn't be a normal thing. But I don't know if I'm bringing today's sensibility into it.
I don't know.
Because it is talking about women not having agency, right?
That's well, it is, but it's also, I think at that time, I mean, really, if you think about it realistically, that wouldn't be considered what we would think as sexual assault.
Yeah.
She was married.
No. It was sexual assault.
It was definitely like, sexual assault.
Even if you take out what really happened out of the equation, what he says is absolutely sexual assault.
Disgusting as heck.
Yeah. And it feels like it's framed to be gross in that movie, but taken off like this is a normal thing. So like you're it's supposed to go on.
Because they're married. That's what I felt like they're like, well, because they're married, it was okay. And it's like, she passed out from drinking.
Yeah, and that's my question. Is the movie saying that it was not okay, or is it passing it off because that was quote unquote accepted at the time? I don't know. That's what I'm like pushing up against, because knowing Polanski's history, I don't necessarily want to give him the benefit of the doubt.
And I don't want to look that up.
But the author, like, I do kind of want to give the benefit of the doubt, because that dude's a good writer. You know, so I don't know. I don't know. But
yeah.
Rosemary becomes pregnant and decides to go to Dr. Hill. The cast of vets insist that she goes to their affluent doctor, Abraham Saperstein, instead. Rosemary's insides are hurting and she loses weight. Saperstein insists that it's normal. Rosemary insists on having a party with her old friends and no one in the building. They see how thin and sickly she looks and tell her to go see Dr. Hill. Rosemary tells Guy she's seeing her old doctor, and Guy argues that Saperstein would be offended. The argument stops when Rosemary's pain ceases and she feels the baby move. Okay, so that was one of those things. When he says the doctor would be offended, I looked horrified. But Amanda just laughed, because she's just like, that is so ridiculous and a thing that you would say. And I was like, what?
Not you getting blamed.
So I guess I'm going to call myself out. I guess that's the thing I would say, but I don't think I would. I do worry about the politeness of people, but not there.
We're going to need to talk.
I do push back on that comment.
Yeah, because it was maddening. I wanted to throw my phone at the screen, because I'm like, what? He stutters. And for now, like back then, you know, someone stutters, you might have known they were lying. That, to me, he was lying, and she did not catch it. She was just like, I'm in pain, and I'm just going to go get a second opinion. But like how he grabs her and shakes her, like that kind of stuff, to me, he's greedy. He knows that if something finds out, anything happens, he's going to lose his career.
Yeah. He's gaslighting her.
Oh my gosh.
He's like pressuring her by like insulting her and trying to put the pressure of all these other people onto her.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's literally shaking her when he's not getting his way. Not super violently, but enough where you're like, you should not be doing that.
You know, he gave her a little shake of, you know?
And especially if you're pregnant, you definitely should not be doing that. Like, you shouldn't be doing it anyway.
You shouldn't be, but now we're really getting, you know?
Now you're shaking two lives.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, what was crazy was his reaction in the party. Oh, when they kicked him out, when she was like crying. Oh, I was loving it. Cause he's like, well, I gotta wash the dishes. It's like, shut up and get out.
Yeah. Cause she wants to talk to her friends. She did not want the neighbors there, because it was just like, she wanted to be in her own safe space.
He's
trying
invade.
To like get into it and like stick his fingers in and keep the friends out. But they were like, no, go to see your doctor. What are you talking about? This is crazy. You look awful.
Like, I mean, like I said, the guy walks in, he's like, man, you look like a piece of chalk. And you're just like, oh, that's kind of good, but dang.
And she does too. And I gotta say, it probably looked more realistic when this movie came out, but because I'm watching it in HD, I'm like, wow, dude, they really put the pancake makeup on. But they're basically telling her all of these bad feelings you've been feeling, you're not crazy. And yes. that is undoing what he's trying to do, which is just gaslight her into doing what yeah. the whole building wants her to do. Ugh. Hutch has been looking further into the building's history, and he wants to meet with her for lunch. He doesn't make the date because he suddenly falls into a coma. It's a pretty good reason to not make a date.
You know?
Months later, a friend of Hutch lets Rosemary know he died, but regains his consciousness enough to tell her to give Rosemary a book called All of Them Witches. What a title for a book. That's such a sexy title. All of Them Witches.
Yeah, All of Them Witches. I was like, oh, okay.
Saying that the name is an anagram, Rosemary at first tries to solve the anagram with the book title, but then realizes Roman Castavet is an anagram for Stephen Mercado. The book has pictures of Stephen, who is the son of Adrian, who summoned the devil. They look identical to Roman. And she's showing him, like, look, it's him. It's clearly him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, yeah, I guess it is. Because he doesn't know how to gaslight his way out of that.
He didn't know how to gaslight his way out of anything. Until
he's kind of an idiot.
He is. But she's also an idiot because, I'm sorry, like, come on, girl. You didn't see the signs. You didn't just, I mean, she's starting to, you know. Hutch, was it Hutch? Is it Hutch or Hutchson?
It's Hutch.
Hutch?
Well, I think Hutch is his nickname. Maybe Hutchinson is his actual name.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weird. I heard like things, but like
I kept thinking of the Will Smith movie Hitch every time I heard Hutch.
You're like, so Will Smith's gonna pop in here at any time. It's like bring back time. Oh gosh, that poor man.
Yeah.
They plotted against him so bad. So bad. And he was smart. And I loved what Cassavetes was his name. I loved when he came in and did all that. I didn't put two and two together that the husband at that time was helping, but I didn't.
Yeah, because you didn't notice he was even, nude yeah, in
even
the scene.
Him, yeah, even him rushing home, like rushing in and being like, oh, hey, what are you doing? You know, it was like so much. And
he's kind of the mastermind of the thing, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
maybe the devil is, but he's the right hand of the devil for sure.
Well, and at that point, I knew Hutch wasn't in on it because everybody else is acting weird but him. He's like, so.
He's trying to get him to not move in the first place,
he
right?
He really
so you
was.
Know he's okay.
Yeah, and then when Cassavetes comes over and he's doing the pendant, Cassavetes has a distinctive stern look that gave me chills when he was watching him. And I'm like, Hutch, you're being watched, dude. You're being watched. Stop talking. Stop talking. You know, so. Yeah, Hutch was a good character. I thought that was I really enjoyed that character.
Rosemary becomes convinced that Dr. Saperstein and the Castavets are satanic and want to kill her baby. Guy gets upset and discards her book. She starts to view her husband with suspicion and goes to Dr. Hill for help. Hill calls Saperstein, who sedates her right before she begins giving birth. She wakes in her apartment and is told her baby is stillborn. She notices that the breast milk is pumped and starts hiding pills that the nurse gives her. She hears a crying baby. Guy says it's a new tenant's child. So I want to go back to the doctor thing. So right around this time, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're still in an era where if women wanted to get on birth control because it was brand new, i.e. the pill, they had to be married and get a note from their husband that it was okay.
Jeez.
Isn't that crazy?
Talk about permission for your own body.
I mean, and obviously we haven't gotten past that yet, but once again, even worse in 1968. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was just so awful when Dr. Hill calls Saperstein. And I have no idea if he was in on the plot or not. I don't think he was.
Yeah.
I think he's just like the way doctors were, which is awful because you have a patient, you're not listening to the patient.
Yeah.
You're immediately going against the patient's will. Played by Charles Grodin, by the way. I think it was one of his first roles. And like, usually he's a funny guy when he shows up and stuff. So
he was like,
I see him and I'm thinking he's going to help her. And then it's like, oh no, you're not going to help her.
I was mad. I was so, cause when, okay, we all, if you're a horror movie fan, all of that, we all know these movies. Oh, let me help you. And you're like, oh my God, he's really going to do it. And then like, she falls asleep, wakes up. And he's like, we're going to tell her you're crazy if you don't, you know, do these things. And it's just like, dang. Because, you know, the doctor and husband show up. Oh, poor woman. She had been running. The phone booth part.
Yeah.
Dude, I was like, okay, girl. But I didn't know if... So this movie, again, it does it where he was standing there. The guy's standing there the whole time. He never turned around. So I was wondering if he, the person that walked off screen, was him. And then the other guy that did come to, that was a person.
This is master filmmaking right here.
Yeah.
Because you get the guy who stands at the phone booth, and phone booth, like for younger people, you used to have to walk into a cubicle to make a phone call. You couldn't pull out a cell phone, right?
Right.
And so she's at the phone booth, and there's just this guy standing there with a trench coat and a hat, and you could just sort of see a silhouette behind her. And it's a very, very, very tense moment.
But you, yeah, his back is turned and you're just, and it's daylight. So it's not, you know, you, so
he's like blotting out the light. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's,
I mean, for the phone booth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's like kind of standing there. And he, I think it's just, there's just this person standing there.
Yeah. It's just a guy waiting for a call. That's all it is. But you don't know that. Just so well done.
It
you
was. Know? Well, when the character walked off screen and then came back, but it was,
I think it's also to play up. Is she just having a bout of mania, right?
Yeah.
Like at the time, I feel like they're playing with the audience expectation a little bit. Like, is she just crazy? Is she just paranoid? Is she quote unquote hysterical? Because that's the thing they always did in movies.
Who's
at that
in
time.
On it? Who isn't? Because apparently the doctor who, you know, was, that's the assistant lady. She didn't know. And then she's like, oh, interesting. That smell, you don't have it on you anymore. And it's like, huh? So that the assistant is just an assistant. So you have to like, you have to like figure out who is what and why. And Dr. Yeah. Hill was definitely one of those ones. That is a why and where and who, because he was just a character in there where very seldomly, and then he called them and you just don't see him again. You don't know.
And what I like about this movie is that there's giant tells to what's going on, because it's directly tied into the people trying to gaslight Rosemary. They're assuming that their gaslight is always going to work. And
yeah.
Sometimes they make such giant leaps in logic. You're like, no way.
That
and so when she's it. Saying the thing about, we're just pumping the breast milk to dump it. Come on. Come on. Like
Rosemary, think smarter, girl. And they're mixing it.
But she figures it out because she says that,
after,
right?
Oh,
that's
I love
what I'm saying. But that is too much of a leap to be like, no, we have to be careful. And she puts the dirty spoon in there and she like freaks out, you know?
Yeah. Oh, the dirty
like,
spoon.
Like, you're just not good at gaslighting, lady.
Yeah. Yeah. That no, not at all.
I chalk that up to 1968. That woman is so used to being gaslit that she doesn't really know how to do it properly.
Oh, no. Not at all.
You need a white male to properly gaslight.
Oh my gosh, that nurse too. That was a fun character. I was like, oh, I love to hate you. There's a lot of love to hate characters in here.
Absolutely. Rosemary grabs a knife and finds a hidden door in their bedroom closet that leads to the Castevet's apartment. We should talk about this really quick because it wasn't in the synopsis. But when they first move in, there's this kind of a closet area, and it had this vestibule or something.
Yeah, is it had that like how a huge it? Like. Had a huge armoire, like it had like something like that, and they move it.
And it was clearly moved in the way. And so that's a tip to the audience, like, why did that happen?
Yeah.
You wouldn't just spend all of this real estate of the movie unless it mattered.
Exactly.
And they want you to think about that. And it turns out it's because if you move those shelves, there's a doorway that goes into the Castevet's apartment.
Ugh.
And so clearly the previous tenant who had died didn't want them in her apartment. She probably found it and was like, I'm not letting them in my apartment.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's what you're supposed to draw.
I mean, I think so, because really, like, the lady, she had died from cancer. It's said in there like, oh, the previous owner, she died from cancer. And really, they probably were mad. They probably casted a spell on her. And
right, because we know that they made this other actor blind. I mean, we're about to find that out.
Yeah, the blindness, the coma with Hutch.
The coma. Yeah, put Hutch in a coma and then he dies. So.
Yeah, and so there was a lot. Yeah, there was a lot that you just don't know. And she did. She moved that. I think she moved that there to, you know.
By the way, one thing I like about this is that we know here in a couple of minutes, you know, we're going to talk about how the husband was in on the whole thing, which we have been talking about. But what I like is they never give him the easy out either, because you could have given him the easy out by like, well, they could make this person blind or they could put this person in a coma. So I felt like I had to protect us. No, they never give him that easy out. It's like, no, I'm doing it for our family to like I get a better career so we get more money. And then we're just kind of like throwing away this first baby and then we can have our own family. And like, guys, it's awful. They never give him that out.
Ever. Sorry. And I rolled my eyes because I'm just like, come on. Come on, man. Just maddening to the point where he was so involved and so just manipulative and gaslighting, like you said, man. And not like, think that's what was making me mad, is like there was so much gaslighting and grooming in there that I was like, I don't like this. This is given very much like y'all are, well, obviously they're a cult in a weird way. They were, you know, doing their thing and kind of getting these women to try to breed, and like that scene, that ending.
Rosemary goes down into the Castevet's apartment. All the tenants and Dr. Saperstein are there with a bassinet draped in black with an upside down crucifix over it. Rosemary threatens her way to the child and screams, "What have you done to its eyes?" Castevet tells her he has her father's eyes. His name is Adrian and he's the Antichrist. Steven tells her that she needs to mother him. Guy says that they'll be rewarded and have their own children. She spits at him. She hears a cry from the baby and starts to rock the cradle from the Antichrist. Haunting ending. Absolutely haunting. Yeah. Like, she goes in there when she has the knife. I feel like it's the only time in the movie that she has any power whatsoever. She's actually openly fighting against them. Mm-hmm. She's not taking the gaslighting anymore. She's figured it all out. She is the one that has them at a disadvantage. Like, they don't have weapons or anything. It seems like they really can't do anything.
Yeah.
And then she hears that baby cry. And it's like, just like all over, because you could tell she's going to fall into what they want her to do.
You can, but then I'm like, is she going to really? I personally thought when she went over to the bassinet the first time, and then the second time, I'm like, that baby's dead. I'm like, kill it, get it. You know, I'm like, we can't have. And then I'm like, she's gonna do it. And then the ending is like that.
It's conformity, look, right? Like, yeah. if you look at the theme of this, it is conformity. How women at the time were just like, this is just what I'm expected to do, so I'm going to do
it. Now I'm going to be its mother. And, like, there was a lot. Man, when she spit in his face, I was vindicated. Honestly, out of all the characters, I think the husband is the one I really was like, if you're going to, like, kill anything, it should be him. That's just my opinion, just because he really put her through some stuff, and so did they. Like,
they're all awful, but, yeah, I feel like in a way the husband... It's hard to say with a bunch of baby murderers and stuff that, like,
yeah, like
they're not the worst, but that is the person that you should love the most in the world. And the fact that you're putting them through that for your own gain.
And watching.
It does make him a bigger villain to me, too. Yeah,
like he.
And you watch him gaslight her more than anybody
else. Oh, yeah. He gaslit. And I like to say groom, because the way they did it, he gaslit and groomed her very, like, he did that. And it's like, whoa, dude, like this is someone you're supposed to love. And. You did this for your career. You didn't do it to have kids and everything else. But there's a lot that comes into play that you're just kind of like, dang. Like, when she comes in there, she does have the knife. When they start yelling, "Hell, Satan," I was just like, ugh. Yeah. I was like, he's like, and it's going to be, and he's doing the speech. And you're just like, oh my gosh, what is happening?
I would like to talk about some stuff around the movie that just kind of makes it weird when you look back at it. Because in itself, this movie is one of the most influential horror movies of all time. Mm-hmm. We talked about some of that up front. And I don't really need to delve into that so much.
Yeah.
But the author, once again, Ira Levin, kind of blamed himself a little bit when he put it out, because he said he felt like that book was responsible for a lot of the fundamentalist stuff that came out afterwards. And I think he was looking at the satanic panic era of like the 70s going into the 80s.
Gotcha.
And he felt like that book had a lot to do with it. I think that it captured people's imaginations, and then they started to go into this thing way deeper with the devil than they were at the time in American society. I don't know if that's true. You know, like, part of me is like, well, maybe you're a little high on your own supply, right? But then another part of me is like, but maybe it was, because once again, we talked about it. I can't come up with anything movie-wise that was anything like this when it came out. And there's so much after this movie that, like, he might be right, honestly.
I think he is. If you think about it, it's 1968, like, watching that and seeing it and even hearing about the book, I wasn't expecting scenes the way they were, especially like the devil in her par where she realizes it's not a dream. For 1968, that's crazy that was going on. That was crazy for a movie like that, or even probably a book. So I will say, like, if we can go somewhere where he is correct, he opened the eyes to say, we can make something like this and make it happen and do good, but do it the right way. You know what I mean? And I can see why he was probably disappointed in being like, we opened this door and now we don't know how to close it.
Yeah. Something else that's kind of crazy looking into this and into the fallout of this movie And once again, going to talk about triggering things with sexual assault. We're not going to get super in depth, but I just don't want to horrify anybody who might not want to hear this. So go ahead and flip the dial if you don't want to hear this. Roman Polanski, 10 years later, assaulted a minor, essentially.
Really?
Yeah, very famously pleaded guilty to having intercourse with somebody who was way too young. And then wound up pleading guilty in a court and then fled to Europe and just lived in Europe forever. If memory serves, after he won an Oscar for Best Picture for The Pianist, 30 years later, he winds up finally getting caught because he got extradited.
Well, yeah, you just made a movie and you moved to Europe.
Dude, he kept making movies. And I know the victim doesn't want people to really go on about it, so I don't want to
absolutely,
too much. But I do find it very ironic that somebody who's talking about women losing their agency, who made this film, to like look at what he did. It's like, dude, you're even guilty of the same things.
Exactly. Well, and like, you continue to go and make movies, and it makes me like, I would, hearing that, you know, it's crazy. Like, that movie was good. Hearing that and knowing what he got away with and everything else, like, I don't know if I'd ever watch another movie by him, though. You get what I mean?
Yeah, he's so steeped in Hollywood history, and I think a lot of these people, you just can't escape it. And so I did want to talk about that a little bit, because this movie, no matter what he did, is going to continue to be in the zeitgeist. It's going to continue to be out there, and people are going to see it. So I would rather talk about that stuff. I think it's important to have these conversations sometimes rather than pretend like it doesn't exist.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, he also made Chinatown, for example. Like, that's a really famous movie that's just going to be around forever. You know, you can't escape it. So the other part of this that I find very crazy is he makes this movie about a cult who's like taking away this woman's agency.
Yeah.
And then the very next year, Sharon Tate, who he is married to, who is pregnant, winds up being killed by the Manson family, like a cult, right?
Jeez.
Isn't that crazy? Like, it had nothing to do with Roman Polanski whatsoever. The Mansons went to that house because Charlie Manson was trying to get a record contract, and he was trying to get in with this producer. And the producer wanted nothing to do with him and was very friendly with him in public, but kept him at a distance because he watched how he used Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
And kind of took over his mansion for a long time and really screwed up his life.
Jeez.
And so the fact that, like, just coincidentally, like, Roman Polanski lived in that house and then his pregnant wife gets murdered with a couple of guests.
Yeah.
And that kicks off this whole thing, like, what a crazy coincidence that is.
It's crazy. And it's actually heartbreaking too. You know what I mean? Just cause look how it all turned. Look, I don't even know if I have words, just cause that is just kind of how the world works sometimes, where it's like, wow, what just happened and why did that happen? You know, but also, do you think that that happened due to his, cause you said a year later after Rosemary's
had nothing to do with this movie
at all,
like at all. You know, like, I feel like everything with that has been out. I mean, the Manson stuff has been trod over, but it was just a weird coincidence. And that's what I find the craziest about it. If there was a connection, you could almost understand it on a level of like somebody was deranged and like saw this and thought, but no, it just worked happened. Out that way. Like, how nuts is that?
But then, but you said 10 years later, he went and did his thing. You know what I mean? Like, why, what was his mind going through at that time? I'm sure there was a lot behind it, but like, or a year later after the movie and then that happened, he's probably going through some stuff, and that like sucks because then he went and did some stuff.
And it's what I really wanted to get into in this movie is that it's all messy. And a lot of people will say things and they will present a certain way. But the truth is, we never really know what the full truth is, you know?
No.
Like, this stuff is messy and it continues to be messy and everybody plays a part in it. And I think this movie is pointing out a lot of those things. But when you look at the history that is tangentially related to the movie, it also informs what the movie is trying to tell you, which is that we are really bad to women. Like, as a society, we look at Roe versus Wade and how, you know, you had an entire political party that for, what, 50 years? That since, like, 1972, has made it a major platform to reverse that decision and take away women's autonomy with their bodies. Yeah. You know, like, we're not above it today. Like, we pointed out some things that are different from 1968, but the core problem is still the core problem. Exactly. Like, that hasn't changed.
And it's not far from it. That movie was definitely, or even in the book, who knows? I didn't read the book, but I definitely watched the movie, obviously. But you feel bad for Rosemary the whole time.
Yeah.
Even at the end, you just feel for her because you want to protect her. You want to know, you want to jump in the screen and say, your husband's an a-hole and, you know, these people are plotting against you. And really, you're right, we aren't too far from it. They could still bring that up today, you know? And so this movie definitely, it's an eye-opener to things and kind of what was expected, like you said, of women, where with her husband, even when he got home, she had dinner and a beer ready for him. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of stuff where today they're looking at it like, that's okay, but really a husband can do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so it is still kind of, it's still in the dark. You know, we're trying to bring light to it, but.
Yeah, it's, how can I put it? The problem is the same. The conversation around it is different, right? That's what I want to get out of this is, you could refilm Rosemary's Baby and just tweak it ever so slightly, and it could still potentially have the same impact in its message that it did then, because it's still true. Yeah. It's also why you don't need to remake this movie, is because with just putting yourself in a 1968 head frame for two or three things, it still absolutely works.
Absolutely. I agree. They actually did redo this movie as a show, and I was going to check it out. Then I'm like, nah, but I feel like I'm going to mess her name up. Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, it's Zoe Saldana.
Saldana, yes. Yeah. So she's actually Rosemary.
It's like a prequel to Rosemary's Baby.
Exactly. And I think there was only like two episodes. I was going to check it out, but it looked like they were kind of going somewhere and then stopped. So it was like probably not worth it. Or maybe they did.
I think it was a miniseries is what it was. Yeah. I read a little bit about it.
It looked good. But like the way I want to know what they're going to do with that, because mostly she is a woman of color, you know. And so now we're going to get into a woman of color. And are we doing it back in the day? Or are we doing it? It looked fairly new. She looked.
Yeah. I don't think you have to set it back in the old times to make it work. You know, like, I think you can set it today and largely still have it work.
Deal.
Are they doing anything with race? I don't know. That's something we should mention too while we're talking about this. I don't want to let this go, but I counted one black person on the screen, like one person who was not white in the entire movie. And he's just an elevator guy.
Yeah. He was the bellman. But
it's New York, man. Yeah. I feel like
who knew
you can't even use the excuse of like, well, this is just a town with a lot of white people. No, dude, it's New York.
Yeah. This is what we're doing. I was wondering if there was going to be any controversy to them changing who Rosemary's skin color.
With a certain amount of people, there will always be that controversy, unfortunately. To me, it's like the race doesn't really matter. Although I will say the husband being a white male kind of works.
Yeah.
That's maybe the one thing I wouldn't change.
Yeah. And that's the thing is he going to be the same? But that again, we are in our today's society. So that's why I'm like, are we going to do a colorism thing where like, they're like, oh, well, you know, interracial couple and blah, 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 blah. You know, I don't know. But again, I kind of wanted to check it out because now I'm like, well, what are we going to do? What's the neighbors going to be like? So I might actually take a peek and see kind of like, now I'm curious because now I want to know. This movie was, again, for 1968, it was very, there's a lot to talk about, you know, but also you're right. You could tweak it just a little bit, but what could you tweak that would make it, you know, more.
I will say, don't do the exact same thing.
No, don't.
Like, I think the core story works, but you need to tweak a little bit. So putting Zoe Saldana in the role, for example, maybe it's an opportunity to talk about race a little bit in a way that could absolutely fit in with how they marginalize women in the movie. You can talk about that a little bit larger than women as well. Maybe that's an opportunity for that, but just don't do the exact same
thing. Please don't. It was a great
justify
movie,
but your existence for doing a remake. Yeah, you know?
Exactly.
Because this still works. We just
because there's so many remakes where you get excited. You know, you're like, oh yeah, that remake, and then you like go and watch it, and you're like, whoa. You completely took out like 10 things that didn't even go with this. You know.
Yeah. You know, there are remakes that elevate from the original.
Mm-hmm.
but that is not the norm, you know, like,
yeah,
for every version of like David Cronenberg's The Fly or John Carpenter's The Thing that absolutely elevate it, there's stuff like Michael Bay's A Nightmare on Elm Street, yeah, where you're just like, come on,
yeah, man. Yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street, I'm like, all right, people, what are we doing? But like The Thing, oh my gosh, that the remake for that, I was kind of impressed. And
The Thing from Another World, the original movie, yeah, it's terrible, yeah, it's just terrible, dude. And it probably worked for that time, but they don't have the whole paranoia thing that's going on there, which, exactly, by the way, is in the book. I read the book. It's, yeah, in the book. They just excised it and they were like, nah, we're going to do kind of a Frankenstein clone here.
Yeah, here we are.
It's not very good. So Carpenter elevates it, I feel like, but that's not the norm with remakes.
No, know? It's not.
The Maltese Falcon is another one. Like, okay, the original one is not good. And then they made a second one 5 years later and it wasn't good. And then 5 years later, John Huston wants to make it again. And they're like, this is a terrible idea. This is already bombed twice in 10 years. And he's like, I really think I could do something with this. And because he does it for a low budget, he makes an all-timer. So it's not a slam dunk, but
I mean, but
you have to be doing something different with the movie.
It worked, you know?
Yeah.
I agree. Like, I mean, if you're going to do this, I want to see, like, if anything, it'd be kind of cool to see Jordan Peele do Rosemary's Baby.
So it's interesting you say that. Jordan Peele actually listed Rosemary's Baby as one of the influences for Get Out. Like, he specifically said that in The Stepford Wives, which are both written by the author of this, right?
So,
that makes sense when you think about it, because everybody in Get Out is gaslighting the main character.
Yeah.
Right? You're like there's that element of it too. And Stepford Wives as well. In Stepford Wives, they're being replaced. You know, like you can see the DNA in Get Out.
Exactly.
And I think great movies are always built off the back of other great movies. Agreed. Like that's just how it works.
Oh, yeah. Know? Oh, yeah. Which is what I think we've said that a lot in this movie with The Exorcism, everything like that. That movie for its time came out in a good way where it paved the way. And like, honestly, I could see Jordan Peele actually doing Rosemary's Baby, but freaking just like making your mind psychologically messed up. I don't really want my mind psychologically messed up, but from a movie, absolutely. I don't want to see.
I would say if Peele remade something at this point, I feel like it's going to be from the production aspect and not from the director aspect, because he seems like he's married to doing original material, which, like, yes, because there aren't very many huge directors who can draw an audience that are making original movies anymore. You've got like Jordan Peele, Christopher Nolan. There's got to be a third one, but I can't think.
I can't
Tarantino,
think of any.
Tarantino, I guess.
Tarantino. Well,
I mean, he's still like making Tarantino. Original
he,
stuff.
He is. I'm a huge Tarantino
If you take into account that he's like pulling moments from movies and kind of mixing them together, but I do think it's an original thing. So there's not very many huge directors that are just like, I'm still going to make an original movie and it's still going to draw an audience. So I don't want Peele to necessarily remake things. Now, he remade Candyman, but he didn't direct it. He just put the money towards it and hired the people, right?
So, which I never watched that Candyman, but apparently it was pretty good.
I really liked it. Been a long time since I've seen the original, but I think it was already talking about race, right?
Candyman was mostly because I remember
it was kind of like a
one.
Civil War thing, right?
And it was still back then that, like, it was because the one original Candyman that I watched, that was back then. I feel like there was a lot of race stuff going on. It was like the ghettos and the, you know, coming up, and you know, here's the what was her name? I think it was Susan was the the main character in there who later on becomes I think Bloody Mary. There was a lot, even in the old school movie, it was unusual for a bright blue-eyed blonde lady going through the hood and caring about something, and then you kind of go through what she's seeing with Candyman, and like the race really came into play. It was different.
Was she white?
Susan, yeah, she was a white lady in there.
So this is actually something before we sign off that I would like to say, though, is that so Clive Barker writes it, you know, who made Hellraiser and things like that. But you have like a white guy who's trying to tell a story about something that happens to the black community. And then of course your way in is a white character.
Yeah. And you're
that's what's good about Candyman when Jordan Peele remakes it, because like you still have that same history, but then they're talking about gentrification. and you're having black characters as your way in, and a black director and a black producer. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's black people telling their own story.
Yeah.
Which I just think makes it inherently better.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people want to rip on it because they love the old Candyman or making bad faith argument. But yeah. I do think that matters. And I think it matters that people get to tell their own stories. And maybe that ties in with Rosemary's Baby in a way, because you are having a white guy write this story with a white guy directing this story. And especially with the director, we already talked about how he doesn't really live up to what the content of the movie is.
Yeah.
So maybe it would be better if Rosemary's Baby, when they're remaking this, I have no idea who the showrunner on it is, but I would hope a woman.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that, like, they're getting some kind of insight that is not in this movie, because I'm a guy watching this, so I'm like, wow, but also I'm a guy. I'm not right there
exactly
in it. And I feel like a woman is going to find things that are way more resonant. And I want to be challenged with a movie like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I was kind of joking about my wife saying, like, that sounds like something you would say with the doctor being offended, you know? But like, I bet there's buttons you could push in that I would be like, oh, I feel terrible about that. That's actually what I want from a movie like that. Right. I want to be challenged and think about what I'm doing.
Hey, man, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to know, how would I handle this situation? You know when someone's gaslighting you, but you don't know necessarily how many times they're doing and why. And so, and I felt like during that movie, there was a lot of times where I'm like, maybe I would have been oblivious. You know what I mean?
It is hard to make the leap to, like, this is a satanic cult that's trying to bring the Antichrist into the world.
Really, they're like being nice to this pregnant woman and they're awesome neighbors. Like, I feel like if you take out the devil
aspect, on the surface, it feels neighborly.
It does.
In an annoying way.
And then
right?
It's not. Yeah. And so I feel like if you take the devil concept, the Satan worshiper out of it, they would just look like annoying neighbors. So if you took that out of that movie, but then later on come to find out the baby that she had was the devil, and this is what they did, you would find that movie a lot different. You'd be looking at it differently, you know?
The last thing I want to bring up, just because I didn't bring it up before, Ruth Gordon really kills it as that super annoying neighbor. You know, like, she's so obnoxious in the perfect way in this.
Yeah.
And she's a comedic actress. A lot of comedic actors and actresses, I look at them and it seems like they're very observational about behavior. And I think that's probably why Ruth Gordon works so well in this movie, is because I think she must have observed super annoying neighbors and understood that, because she really does, man. If you take out the satanic stuff.
Oh yeah.
I've known people who are exactly that.
Exactly. Coming in and, oh man, that first scene where she's in there looking through the apartment, I'm like, what are you looking for? What do you want? And really, she's just a nosy neighbor. And so she's like, oh girl, yeah, let me stay. Let me help you out. It's like, no. You live upstairs.
Yeah.
Go not back upstairs.
In my apartment.
Yeah. So why are you here? So she
And they
did
set
good.
Her up perfectly, because they're doing the whole thing where she's talking about, oh yeah, your previous neighbor grew this herb and that herb and that herb. It's like, oh man, you must have annoyed them all the time.
Which is probably why she put that armoire in front of the closet.
She didn't even know there's a satanic plot. She's just like, this goes up to their apartment? No. We cannot have her having access to my apartment.
Get out. Oh my gosh. No, this movie was good. That neighbor, like I said, the neighbor, she kind of actually was one of my faves. I was like, I really liked her. I was like, even though she was annoying, but she was like, she was to the point, and she was the distraction. That was the distraction. She was the one that you're kind of, like I said, the cake part, all of that, where the husband and the husband are talking. She was there to do that. She was the psychological part where you were like getting angry. The husband was that kind of in your face. You already know what's going on.
Yeah. And the other thing with that character, and I talked about this with my other co-host, Aaron Donaldson, on Fields of Glory on a Batch episode, we were talking about A League of Their Own.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to point out patriarchy in that movie. And I was pointing out that Dottie in that movie is part of the patriarchy. And we don't always think about a woman being part of the patriarchy, but when they are setting the tone for how a woman's supposed to behave,
that's me.
And it matches with the patriarchy.
Yeah.
You are a part of the patriarchy, even if you are being you know, like pushed down by the patriarchy. That is Ruth Gordon's character in this. Like, very she is much. Part of that patriarchy, that whole society saying you have to be like this.
Yeah.
You have to be a housewife. You have to go to this doctor. You have to keep the baby.
And
you
he's
have
the to, best. Yeah. And you got to have the best of the best. That's why you're doing what you do. And this, you know, there's.
So she's, in a way, she's kind of the worst because, like, she is also subverting, you know, her own rights in a way by doing this to somebody else.
Exactly. Which
just makes you feel like this is a character who's like a total betrayer, you know?
When you see the part where the devil in Rosemary and she's just like, be quiet, keep chanting. It's like, oh, that's what kind of character you are. So then you kind of really see it. But really, she was, again, she was the part of your brain where you're like, oh my gosh, what is Tannis Root? What are you doing? What is, you know, whatever, which I think it was called the devil's pepper. But
right. I kind of forgot there was a point to the Tannis Root other than realizing that she wasn't wearing it anymore.
Exactly. You know? It's a devil's pepper.
And it turned out it was a mold, right?
Yeah, it was a fungus mold.
It was not
actually
Tannis Root.
It was bad. But that character, she was the psychological part. She was that one where you were like, what are you guys plotting? And why are you secretive? And why are you coming down here all the time? What is this stuff you're feeding her? And you don't get it until the very end.
Well, I'm really glad you liked this movie,
man.
Yeah,
it was great.
I wasn't sure, but I was firing it out there. I wanted something substantive.
It got me.
About.
This had my heart racing. The person I was hanging out with was like, are you okay? Because I was like tense. No one can see it now, but I'm like grabbing them and I'm like, what's happening? And like, I was sitting up. This is a definite like sit up in your seat. It was a great movie. Good pick. Of New York, number one original. Wake up, pop culture of my time.
Cosmic Void was created by Alex Small and Jeremiah Perez. It's hosted by Alex Small and Xavi Cousins. Produced by Aaron Donaldson and Alex Small. The theme song Duke of New York A No. 1 was written by Dub Campbell and Greg Vivrette. The song is performed by Tonight We Ride. A Cosmic Void is a Redwood Sound Labs production.
Okay, kiddo, I lost my library of sound, so I need you to do some sound effects for me.
I don't want to do this, Dad.
Look, I'm just trying to put food on the table, but if you don't want to help,
all right.
Hear Biggs chronicle a galaxy of genres. Listen to the deconstruction of film on A Cosmic Void. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you have a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast, Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. You can find all of Redwood Sound Lab shows at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.